This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Bruce Rastetter, founder and executive chairman of Summit Agriculture Group. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Summit Agriculture Group's Bruce Rastetter next. Did you know the price of U.S. sugar for American households is about 5% lower than other developed countries? In the U.S., 11,000 sugar beet and sugarcane farmers produce sugar under some of the world's strictest safety, labor, and environmental standards. These hardworking Americans support 151,000 jobs across 24 states, maintain a reliable domestic supply chain, and contribute over $23 billion to the economy. American sugar companies pay fair wages and offer good benefits to their workers, including union jobs vital to rural and urban communities. The sugar program is the safety net for sugar producers in the Farm Bill. It has strong bipartisan support in Congress and is designed to cost the taxpayer $0. The current sugar program provides flexibility to allow for a reliable supply throughout the year and to accommodate imported foreign sugar required under our trade commitments. Weakening the sugar program would lead to greater dependence on unreliable foreign suppliers, costing us American farmers, blue-collar jobs, and domestic food security for this essential ingredient. For more, visit the American Sugar Alliance at sugaralliance.org. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Iowa's Bruce Rastetter always intended to use a political science degree to step into a career as a lawyer, but business led him to opportunities in livestock and eventually renewable fuel. He's overcome challenges and found success in both the United States and Brazil. He reflects on his career and is willing to offer advice for potential entrepreneurs in the ag industry.
Yeah, I think be open to change. I mean, I think like in my situation, it happens with the number of people that you can't always do what you'd love to do or dream to do. You know, when you start out, so if you're driven and you hook up with the right people who value hard work, logical thought thinking, common sense, and technical skills, you can create opportunity in those companies or in those opportunities, because there's a ton out there today that may let you get to the point where a number of kids want to go home and row crop farm and it's not large enough and the land values are high. But, you know, contract hog buildings are a great way without production risk to lower nutrient costs and to make an add net worth to in value that you may not be able to farm right away, or an opportunity to have sales or work with technology that people need and don't understand as well as young people coming out of college. So I happen to think that, you know, the best days of ag are ahead, and clearly responding to the marketplace is really the critical aspect of the evolving ag world we live in.
So we're working in a situation in livestock where there are headwinds that are coming from a certain number of activists. They were successful with Prop 12 in California, the Supreme Court. They left it to Congress. How do those headwinds, how are they affecting, and do you expect that they will continue to affect the confined livestock operations in the country?
Yeah, I think it will. And I think clearly when some people voluntarily years ago worked with McDonald's on animal welfare issues rather than going through, and they volunteered the industry for a variety of those changes, I think it's set in motion for the pork industry in particular and layers, the change that's going on that, you know, oftentimes there will increase costs. But I think at the end of the day, the biggest concern for ag is the embrace of science and technology to create a better life and telling that story that it's done that. So we have safer food, more abundant food, and lower costs in the world than has ever existed because of that embrace. And I think that gets lost in the message And then you have people with alternative motives that a number of the motives of Prop 12 is not animal welfare, but they just don't like people eating protein and eating meat. So, but I think we can combat that with how safe, wholesome, and the animal welfare that exists. But at the end of the day, it will cost consumers more, and it'll cost poor people more in terms of the cost of food. That's really unfortunate. And I think that's where education and the embrace of that message is really important.
Let's look over your shoulder if we can. You've started a number of businesses. I'd be interested in if you would be willing to share mistakes perhaps that you've made, or mistakes that you see entrepreneurs making when they start a business, especially an agriculture business.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our philosophy with the company B is that you have to be entrepreneurial, and you have to make, you know, reasonably quick decisions and not do a ton of things by committee. Or you need to gain consensus, but you don't need to wait for the committee to decide on the consensus. There has to be leadership. And I think with it, you know, it's going to come mistakes, and there'll be mistakes otherwise. And I think once you make a mistake, I think it's recognizing it more quickly, and then it's changing things. And, you know, I've made a number of mistakes being too optimistic about our, you know, models that we would put in place. You know, we had 9-cent hogs in 1998. It was a 50-year low. Our model was 20 years. You know, we've had $8 corn and $1.70 corn during that whole time frame. And I think being overly optimistic in ag, I think sometimes instead of taking profits when we can, you know, we always want that extra, because there's a variety of things that can go wrong, because we don't make widgets when you make pigs. There's a variety of different factors that come to play. So I think, you know, missing some commodity markets, probably the biggest mistake. And I continue to make that. We try and get better. And I think the big thing an early investment banker in Heartland Pork told me is, you know, admitting you made a mistake and don't make that same mistake twice. And I think young people, and we had given a gift to the entrepreneurship program at Iowa State. And I think the biggest thing is the people that they rely on for advice, whether you call that a mentor or just, I've had some great people in my lifetime that share, you know, where they made mistakes, and how to avoid that, and how to recognize that you're not perfect. And I think that a number of young people, it's really difficult today's world to have the time to communicate rather than reading, and reading everything and getting it off the internet, and rather than talk to somebody who's made those same mistakes.
Your career has had a tremendous evolution, from carrying the mail to selling feed, and then from pork production to corn-based to ethanol production, partnerships in beef, pork, and grain production. Talk about that evolution and how it's come to be, and maybe what's ahead.
Yeah, I think the challenge for some people, and because it just happens, you get kind of siloed in one industry, and a variety of the things that I've done have been an evolution. So I wanted to sell feed to be able to farm, and then once sold feed, livestock feed, Iowa changed, and so we needed to contract feed pigs because farmers lost lines of credit on the pigs when the land values dropped. And so I think a variety of those things just evolve, and it's back to the ability to accept change. But then when you do that, if you're not an expert in that field, either technically or education or experience, then you better quickly find people that are honest, have integrity, that you can work with, that within those different industries. So I look at, and you know, I don't need to know a lot about the seed industry, but you know, I rely on Harry Stein's expertise in that, and which is why we represent Harry and Mata Grosso selling Stein seed. And ICM, I will never in my lifetime learn what Dave Vandergren with ICM knows on technology, on ethanol plants, which is why he's built two-thirds of them. And I think if you go about life and trying to sort through the what I think are the best relationships of honest people who want to do business the right way, it is just so much easier to be involved in different spaces. And same thing's true on the private equity side. And you know, you hear a lot of horror stories about people in New York and how deals never deal, and you have these financial geniuses running around changing language and agreements that you've agreed on. You know, I've been fortunate with the people we work with that they have a lot of integrity, and what they say they're going to do, we end up writing in the agreement to do. And you try to live by that. And so I think it really is just, you know, that then being open with them on mistakes. We lost a lot of money in Heartland Pork, and they still worked with me because of the market. And when we sold Heartland Pork, they worked with me to develop the ethanol company that we were successful with. And had they not had that experience and that outcome that maybe didn't turn out exactly like any of us, or it didn't like any of us would have liked, we wouldn't have had the success with Hawkeye. And then continuing to work with some of those very same people on Summit Carbon Solutions to try and help transform and propel the ethanol industry like we are today with that project.
Now, you've invested in Brazil. You've got one of the largest biofuel production plants in South America. What have you found to be the advantages or maybe the disadvantages of being a U.S. entrepreneur in that Brazilian energy space?
I think if you first start out with the premise that, Jeff, that Brazil's going to be the other country in the world produce the majority of the world's food going forward outside the U.S. And that was our first assumption, and I think that's pretty well certain and proven. Two, they most readily accept U.S. technology outside of the U.S. of any country in the world. So the same John Deere high-speed planter tractors we have at Summit on our farming operation, farmers have in Mato Grosso. Two, that with biotechnology and genetics improvement, Brazil in particular, double crop area Mato Grosso is going to raise a massive amount of corn going forward because they accept that technology and they double crop where we can only single crop. So we viewed, rather than sugarcane ethanol, that there was a great opportunity to locate in the middle of the continent. They embrace biofuels. They embrace biofuels with consumer choice, which I've been an advocate for in the U.S. for a long time. And with that, then, if you're in a low-cost area of the country producing second crop of the world, producing second crop corn on surpluses that are going to grow, it's just a great spot. But then again, you need U.S. technology. So we took Dave Vandergen and ICM with us to build these plants. And we blended American Brazilian culture in the company and feel very good about the position of that company, the opportunity, and, you know, its ability to continue to grow.
I'm putting brackets around the U.S. in the current administration's window of leadership. Does their decisions on RVOs and the RFS and emission standards and push for electric vehicles, does that cloud your optimism about the future of ethanol and the renewable fuels industry here in the U.S.? Does it make Brazil look even more inviting?
No, and actually in Brazil, you know, where we learned about low carbon fuels is our Brazilian company had to go through their Renovo Bio program to rate the carbon sustainability score of the gallon of ethanol that we produce against every energy company in Brazil. And that's where the carbon score that we attained in Brazil came about, second crop corn, biomass, no natural gas. And it really led us to how do we respond to the marketplace with U.S. ethanol. I care about U.S. agriculture. We care about how we have markets. Ethanol consumes 60% of the corn in Iowa, 50% nationwide. We better maintain that market and grow it. And it's back to we've always responded to markets in agriculture. And this is no different. And we've always had government policies that affect us, right? We had MTB. We had RFS, we had Blender's Credit, we have Brazilian Tariff, and now we have an RFS, we have 45Q, 45Z that incentivize and lowering carbon scores, which my view is it's only creating a product that consumers want that can be an alternative to electric vehicles and more sustainable and better for the environment, as we know, without the societal changes and impacts that electric vehicles unfortunately would have. But we've got to be an alternative. And I'm more optimistic on the U.S. ethanol industry if we get carbon in the ground and we go to net zero ethanol, which we can do. And if we do that, the ethanol industry has a brighter future than ever before because you'll have higher blends of ethanol teamed up with lower carbon oil to save the combustion engine. But more importantly, you have a massive market in sustainable aviation fuel that can only be solved utilizing ethanol. But if U.S. ethanol doesn't lower its carbon scores 32 points, it won't qualify for sustainable aviation fuel. That is a 75 billion gallon potential industry, Jeff. I mean, if you think about that, we're all chasing, we're worried about RVOs, and we're worried about can we, like, inch up the RFS. When if we lower carbon scores, which we will do for 34 ethanol plants signed up with us, with Summit Carbon Solutions, they suddenly have access to sustainable aviation fuel, that the technology is there, that you aren't going to have enough fast oil greases to supply basically anything there. We all know that the cost increase on all that has been dramatic, and there's a limit. But there's no limit to the productivity of U.S. agriculture if there's markets and profitability. We've seen that now with 15 billion bushel corn crops. So I get pretty excited about it. And will Brazil have a place? Sure it will. But Brazil today struggles to produce enough ethanol for its growing combustion engine, which it's going to, you know, they can use 100% ethanol in vehicles. And it too will be needed to sustain it, because it isn't like we're going to go from 15 billion gallons of ethanol to 50 anytime soon. But we will have a much less constrained market with those lower carbon scores that give us that market. And then when farmers hit us hard about climate change or this or that, this, you know, I view it as improving the environment, as ethanol always has, but you know, in my mind, this is about attaining markets. In order to change the markets, we got to lower the carbon scores. But all we're really doing is make it more sustainable and responding to consumer demands. And yes, government policies. But we have to do this to be an alternative to electric vehicles, or this country's got a problem on tripling electric costs. And then agriculture's got an issue on what are you going to do with 7.5 billion bushel of corn piled up out there.
Summit Carbon Solutions trying to build a pipeline from ethanol plants to sequester carbon in the ground in North Dakota. Why is that so important now for U.S. ethanol plants?
Well, I think it's so critical because if you think about U.S. ethanol plants from the beginning, they start out with a score of about 99, which is real similar to gas, you know, oil. And with all the hard work done in the industry, more efficient plants, less water use, less MTB use of net gas use, more efficient, you know, 3-to-1 yield of ethanol to corn instead of 2-5 when it started. All that has contributed to lowering carbon scores to 50 to 55. And this single project lowers the carbon score from 55 minus 32 points. So a number of these plants are, you know, will be 18, some of them will be 25, and then there's other things they can do with post-combustion CO2 capture to lower it again. And the reason that's important is that with the other things going on in ag, the increasing yields, we'll have nitrogen plants sign up on our pipeline that lower the carbon intensity of a unit of nitrogen that goes on to produce an acre of corn. With that corn going to the ethanol plant, it also lowers that total to get to net zero carbon. So if you have a net zero carbon, a more efficient, low-cost plant that has a lower carbon score than a battery-driven electric vehicle without all the consequences to it, both environmentally, where the minerals come from, but more importantly, the sustainability side. You can capture that market that doesn't exist today, but also maintain markets that grow for you, like sustainable aviation fuel. And one of the real moments in the last few months I had is hear the head of United Airlines Sustainability say that corn ethanol is the only input available for sustainable aviation fuel to make an impact and that can grow. And when we think about all this industry has been through on food versus fuel and all that BS, how important it is to have airlines embrace that. Because the alternative for them is to do what Europe's doing and lowering carbon scores. If they don't get enough SAF, you fly less. And I don't think we need a world that only wealthy people are flying around in with ticket prices going up, but with less availability. That's the wrong direction. But also society, it's back to science and technology. We can solve this, and we can solve it with a pipeline that actually helps agriculture and ethanol compared to, you know, Iowa number, Jeff, throw out for you. Iowa has 46,000 miles of pipeline. You know how many we're building in Iowa? 700. And our pipeline is the only one that directly benefits agriculture. Yeah, the other ones, we need nat gas, right, to run corn dryers. We need that to run ethanol plants. We need oil pipelines like the Dakota Access coming from the Bakken that came through years ago. That isn't a direct benefit to Iowa ag. Like, this pipeline will create new markets. And every one of our ethanol plants, once we get our permits, is planning to institute 25 to 30% growth in that plant, which means greater corn markets in that local area, and means that because of their increased profitability, because of this, they will be able to pay more for corn, as much as a dollar a bushel compared to today, and still break even. I mean, to me, that's transformative. And yeah, we've had people that don't like this. We have detractors. We have the Sierra Club, who hates modern ag, hooked up with, you know, extreme anti-climate people. This isn't about the climate. It's about improving the environment, but it's more importantly about accessing new markets for farmers and those ethanol plants.
You've paid a number of landowners for access to their land to build this pipeline, and some don't want it. You're, as I understand, seeking the use of eminent domain. So how do you respond to the critics?
Yeah, so I think, this will be the most expensive pipeline ever built in Iowa. I mean, we have record land prices, but we are paying very well for those easements. The farmers will be able to farm above, just like they do the 46,000 miles of pipe currently under their ground. But what I think everyone ought to realize for development, there is not a highway, a pipeline, or a transmission line built without the use of eminent domain, because there's simply going to be some people that don't want anything touching their ground. But I think what I would say, and all the companies that have built these are private companies, right? You have Berkshire Hathaway, you have Alliant, you have Dakota Access Pipeline. They're all private companies, so they're no different than what we are. But I think more importantly, what we will do is not only are we paying them well, we have a farmer-friendly easement. So we're indemnifying them. We're voluntarily putting our easement that we're going to have the land restoration that other pipelines haven't done, and making sure that we are there till the compaction is gone. And we also are doing things like route changes. We made 2,700 route changes. We have paid up front $134 million to Iowa on Iowa easements. And we have, which is also because of that easement and how we're considering tile fixes and how we're tracking things and the soil restoration and the depth of the tile. We're putting it under the depth of county tile or the larger tile. Because you need to do that if you're ever going to then come back and pattern tile that farm. in the appropriate way. So, I mean, we're farmers. I signed the same easement. The pipeline's coming through a farm that I pattern tile a number of years ago. And, I get it on farming. In most places, it's only a 6-inch pipe. I mean, most of these guys we're working with put 12 to 14 inch mains in. So it's less intrusive. Where needed, we're boring it under in those areas and we're route changing. So, but the important thing is we're going to impact every bushel of corn they sell where we go through. We're going to impact 15 million acres of U.S. farm ground, and arguably we're going to impact the industry. So I think the other part that I feel good about is over approaching 75% of Iowa landowners have signed voluntary easements with us. There's not been a pipeline built in Iowa that we're aware of that's had that high a level of voluntary support. And there's not been another pipeline that directly impacts ag. So I think you roll up all those things and yeah, I mean, today's world is a contentious world. You know, I get it. And our messaging has not been perfect and has been challenging at times. And we get it. It's about the farmer and how we treat the farmer. It's about the new markets and it's about keeping those jobs and that biofuels production in that local community. And so we have record land values, and in case anybody hadn't looked lately, we got 482 corn down from 750 earlier this year. And so we need these markets. We can produce abundant crops, as clearly noted, and we can produce very abundant crops in challenging weather conditions. And it's because of all the investment that we've talked about. So, you know, I think that the voluntary numbers of the majority of Iowa farmers have signed easements with us should suggest to people that we're doing a lot of things right with this.
Well, Bruce Rastetter, we want to thank you for taking time from such a busy schedule to spend with us here on Open Mic. Congratulations on your success in the industry, and much success and best wishes for you in the years and the seasons to come. This is Open Mic, and today, sir, you've got the last word.
Well, I think maybe the last word, and kind of falls in line with some of the questions that you had, Jeff, is that I would just encourage, one of the challenges with U.S. agriculture is to be open to change. And when you talked about the different things I've done, maybe I just couldn't hold a specific day job, but specifically, and I evolved into different industries, that if you are have an open mind and a willingness to accept change, then it will create greater opportunity for you than ever thought existed. And to me, that I think is the continuing aspect for our organization, is you don't have to be the brightest guy in the room. I'm not. A variety of folks aren't. But you've got to know the people that are the brightest people in the room. So I'd leave you with that. I really appreciate the time and the question.
Our thanks to Bruce Rastetter, founder and executive chairman of Summit Agriculture Group, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the American Sugar Alliance. Learn more about the benefits of the sugar industry to the nation at sugaralliance.org. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.